Hey, Chick Flick Fix fans, this is Julia here, coming to you with a little bonus episode. If you haven't checked out the Agents of Smooch here on The Incomparable, you really, really should. This summer they did a sort of little travel series that was really fun. I got to guest on a couple of episodes, and one of those was this one about the amazing movie Eurovision, The Story of Fire Saga, which if you haven't watched, you really, really, really should. So here, for your enjoyment, is the Agents of Smooch talking about Eurovision, the Story of Fire Saga.
Welcome back to Agents of Smooch. We are going to Iceland for a mission that is so, 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 so bad. It's super tremendous. When Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga debuted this summer, our agents knew we needed to add an extra stop for our vacation. It is going to be a very sexy time. I am director Annette Weirstra, and today I have with me agent Sage Young. Hello, Sage.
I'm checking you out. Yes. Thank you for having me. I'm super excited.
Well, you started this. Oh yeah, you started this. We were on Facebook and like, we should just do an episode about this because it's so
heck yes.
Good. Spoiler. I also have with me agent Moises Chuyan. Hey, Moises.
Let's go sex nuts.
This movie is so quotable.
Yep.
I have also brought in our very own Eurovision expert from Sweden, Agent Julia Scott. Hello, Julia.
I've been trying all day to think of the best, like, actual Eurovision quote to bring into it, and I realized it will be funny exactly only to me.
An audience of one.
I could say, I was defeated. This movie won the war.
This movie came out to Netflix, and I'm just so interested in it because I think the general expectations around this movie that I heard from so many people is that they expected it just to be really bad. And to be fair, I know some people who really don't like this movie. But I also hear a lot from people who watched it and were like, wait, what is this? This is kind of awesome. And I think that it is so interesting. I want to know your expectations about this because I was like, it looks like it's okay. And I would take a winger on it and then was just texting with my friends, like my little comments as I often do about the movie. And then I was like, no, wait, guys, you actually do have to watch this because it's kind of great. So how are your feelings about this movie when you saw it coming?
I mean, for me, because I love Eurovision completely unironically and with my full heart, I was like, yeah, this is awesome. And I was briefly worried because, you know, Will Ferrell does, you know, parody of a passion very well, but sometimes it can be a bit much for me. But then I love a lot of the things he does. And then I remembered his wife is Swedish. He has spent a lot of time in Sweden. I'm assuming that she has forced him to watch a lot of this. So I also figured there would be a lot of love there. And I have a passion for, you know, movies with lots of musical numbers, and I have any kind of passion for, like, you know, an underdog story, and we have to save the ice rink / dad's house / whatever, like, that whole, like, competition movie. So this had everything for me. Plus, it was really funny because the actual Eurovision Song Contest was canceled this year, mm-hmm. and the actual entry from Iceland this year was amazing. Like, I was fully expecting it to win, and I was like, is coronavirus just a big conspiracy so that Iceland couldn't win, or was it a conspiracy from Iceland because they couldn't afford to host next year?
Oh, that is the question.
Going off of Julia's point, I think I had read some things either leading up to this or after I watched it the first time, that the whole genesis of this project was that Will Ferrell loves Eurovision and mm-hmm. had gone last year and done like sort of a just to be there and to like take it in and do some research and stuff like that. So yeah, it definitely like comes from a place of love and in terms of my actual expectations, I think being that the theatrical release slate has changed so much over the last like 10, 15 years, there aren't a lot of just like sort of moderately priced or even cheap comedies that are R-rated that make it to, or like R-rated PG that like make it into theaters. And I kind of miss that little bit of genre. Like, there just aren't a lot of like moderately fine comedies that are, you just go to see on a Saturday afternoon with your friends. And so it felt to me like to have it just drop on Netflix and for everyone to be able to watch it whenever they could in the middle of a pandemic was like, what a little gift, you know? It just was like, it felt like something that had been missing for me. And also, you know, I know that some people find like Will Ferrell's stuff like tiresome occasionally, but you know, I was probably like a freshman in college when Old School came out, you know, like I watched him on SNL all through high school. Like I think I, whether or not I love every single one of his movies, I certainly like have grown up on that comedy. And it was really fun to see him in a part that had like, that had a lot of heart too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was looking forward to it, but I didn't know that I would love it as much as I do.
When he's in semi-sentimental mode, that's when his movies work the best for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did not have high expectations of Blades of Glory, for example, and ended up loving it when I finally watched it and kicked myself for missing it theatrically. I think his reputation precedes him inaccurately, where I look back at most of what he's done, and I need to be in the mood to not be overly analytical and just enjoy something a bit silly and a bit ridiculous. And when you add Rachel McAdams to his riffing ability, that the things that I picked out in this movie that I assume were extended riffs of his, she was so good in Game Night when she was allowed to just do pure comedy, and she's been good at that her whole career. And this movie unleashes her and, you know, had me wanting yet more of her, not because of Will or anything, but because she was so good. And then you add Shirtless Under a Blazer, Dan Stevens, and you have a trailer that has me going, yes, I want this. I want this now. I'm really big into singing competition movies, singing competition reality stuff hosted by Graham Norton on the BBC. And I just, yes, it's a movie. Yes, it's fake. It's fictional, but that doesn't mean that you don't get invested in the characters, even if, you know, it's Pierce Brosnan doing a ridiculously bad Icelandic accent. You get invested in this stuff because of the kind of narrative that it's wrapped around. And it's just, it's delightful. And little cameos here and there, little, you know, bit parts, you know, throughout are delightful. And initially I looked at it and I went, 2 hours? Do I really need 2 hours of this? Yes, I needed 2 hours of this 4 viewings later.
Yeah, I've watched it 3 times now, in part because I knew we were going to record this. But I think what you said, Sage, about it having heart, and I think we often underestimate comedy and it's always seen as a lower form than a dramatic movie. But I also agree, Moises, when you say that when Will Ferrell gets sentimental, he can be really great at that. And I think that's part of why Elf is such a powerful movie. And I also really love Stranger Than Fiction, which is a much more serious.
I
was like, I love that movie so wonderful. Much. And that movie actually transformed my opinion of him as an actor. And you go, wait a second. You're falling into that trap where you think that people, just because they're being funny and silly and comedic, they're not talented. And so I think he actually is, I give him a lot more credits, and that's part of what I was. I didn't expect Rachel McAdams to be this funny either.
I think comedy is, you know, kind of like figure skating in that it has to look effortless, and that makes you forget that this is not something everyone can do.
Yeah.
It's just this like beautiful, smooth, I mean, not always, but when done well, it has to be this smooth, beautiful thing. And we forget that, and we think like it's harder to look brooding, kind of. And a lot of times you see comedic actors will make the best dramatic actors because they have had to really hone everything about that. And I feel like you know, Will Ferrell, like you're all saying, like, we forget that because almost all the things he does are with heart, and then like parts of them can maybe go beyond where certain people think things are either still funny or get funny. But you can tell, like, all of the things that he sort of satirizes or riffs on are things that he or someone in a project knows things about. They're not just making fun of people who like car go fast. You know, like, there's there's always something there. And what is so amazing is they have what I think is sometimes, you know, in literary theory called, like, cross-vocalization, that which you sometimes talk about, like, this works both if you know the stuff and if you don't. Like, it works for the people who are like, I can spot every reference here and I know exactly who that is supposed to be, and this is funny because that tire doesn't go on that car or whatever, but it can be just as funny if you don't. And that is a very special kind of heart to be able to accomplish.
There's also the element of, like, repetition that he does, which I, like, some people find annoying. I think the point is that it is supposed to get to that point where it's annoying and then it becomes funny again. Like, the whole point is to sort of wear out the joke, right? Like, it's not, like, that's not happening, like, by mistake. They're intending for that to happen. And there's a really good, it's a very old story on This American Life where Kurt Braunohler, the comedian, tells a story about how he and Kristen Schaal, when they used to do this show together, would just do this bit where, like, Kristen Schaal would dance around the stage and he would just sing this, like, four-line song that was like, Kristen Schaal is a horse. And they just did it for like 15 minutes. And he said they would keep doing it because they wanted to see, like, the audience would, like, laugh, and then they'd sort of uncomfortably laugh, and then they'd get quiet, and then they'd laugh again. Like, it was just like watching that, because it's you know, it's toying with your expectations of, like, when you think something is supposed to be over. So I always find that kind of, like, comedy nerd stuff really fun to observe.
Yeah, people make fun of his monomyth comedy template that is used in a lot of his movies, and it's pieces of it are used here too, and it's that he gets that certain things are ridiculous, and he gets that certain things are just this massively overconfident, not as talented as he thinks he is character, and he just commits to the bit, and committing to the bit is most of what you have to do. And so many people are so much more self-conscious about looking like an idiot than great comedians are. And that's so much of why the performance here works so well. And even if it starts to wear thin at parts, Rachel McAdams and other parts of the movie keep things fresh, and it doesn't feel like you are watching just his movie. He is at the center of the movie, but there's enough going on otherwise that it doesn't wear out its welcome.
And I think also that sort of monotone style, like, somehow he and Rachel McAdams are both equally hilarious and play it equally straight.
Yes.
Somehow. Like, they as characters don't make jokes.
Right.
But half of the things they say are so funny because they're so relaxed about it, and it's almost not bizarre until you remember that it is. Because they're just, like, you know, doing their thing backstage. And it's just, that is a hard sort of pinpoint to achieve the way I think they do here.
I was also super surprised by Dan Stevens, who it took me a minute to recognize him with his Wham hair. And I was like, wait a second, that's Matthew Crawley from Downton Abbey being so funny. And his character was also had a lot of heart to him for someone who was sort of set up to be a air quote villain.
Right.
And I kind of like that they subverted that they had a villain at the contest, because really there's no, well, there is a villain, but it's not within the frame of the contest.
I like that he is like, and everything he sort of wants for Sigrid or wants from her is what she should be doing anyway. Like, he's just like, you are super talented and I think we could be great. He's not really and he sees that she's being undervalued by her partner.
100%.
And so he's like, this is not great for you. I wouldn't do that to you. Like, let's go make something great. And that's not necessarily, like you say, like, it totally subverts the idea that he's the bad guy because he's just observing things. Like, when she says something about, like, he says something to her about, like, singing from her heart or whatever, and she's like, that's just what my mother says. Like, he somehow, like, just meets her and is like, gets it, you know? And I want a spinoff movie about Alexander.
Oh, please.
So
yes.
Badly. Just, like, go home to Russia and do, like, a tour.
Yes.
Because he's so amazingly just, like, earnest and yes. sincere. And he's set up that we're supposed to see, like, he's manipulative. He's going to steal her. But like you're saying, he sincerely cares about her. He doesn't take advantage of her when she's had a bit too much to drink. And in another movie, he would have lied to her and or Lars about them having slept together so that he would cause drama.
Right.
But he's just like, no, of course that, you know.
He's a gentleman.
He's a gentleman and he's not evil. He's just an artist like that. And I really, really like you were like, I completely agree. And I was saying that after I watched it, like, I really appreciate that the things he says are all like true, you know?
The line Secret says when Lars gets really mad about it and Secret says, at least he sees me. And Lars says, I see you every day. And Secret says, no, you don't. And I was like, wow, that was like such a punch in exactly the heart of them. That's like, that's the movie right there. And that's like Lars's journey.
That was really one of my favorite things is that he was able to be self-motivated and self-centered about things. But I mean, so are Lars and Secret. You honestly get the red herring of, oh, there are two villains in this movie. In addition to the bureaucratic guy from the Bank of Iceland. He gets more dimension than we expect from somebody who starts to be set up as that kind of a villain. And you're like, oh, I kind of like this guy. Please. I don't want him to be a scumbag. He's kind of interesting. And oh, good. I was validated. He was not, in fact, a total scumbag.
Yeah.
And from my perspective also, because we get, you know, at the very, very end, we get like, okay, we get kind of a confirmation that, yes, he probably is in the closet. But all the way through I'm like, because when he says there are no gay people in Russia, that's very much actually like a thing that people will say, but also both in like parts of Russian culture and definitely in parts of Eurovision culture, like all and any sort of hints, references, style that would say anything about sexuality are just like completely gone. Like a certain type, because he could almost have all those oiled up, half naked male dancers being suggestive and just be like, no, we are macho men. That is what we do. And I just love how it's just like in this weird little sort of spiral of what is actually going on. And then maybe like it doesn't actually matter. But of course, it is very, very sad if he's in the closet in Mother Russia, because that is not a good life to have.
Yeah, he's kind of like a tragic character. I'm like, oh, he's so talented and like good-hearted, and he just is, oh god. Also his delivery of he him pronouns, so good.
Yes.
He him. I also like, there's a line alluding to that too, because doesn't, when Lars is like, he's a sex player, and he's like, who else would walk around with these four muscular men?
Exactly.
But like a heterosexual sex player, so great. The layers, y'all.
Yeah, they would be hot, busty women if that was the case. But hey,
yeah, he's comfortable in his masculinity.
But he has also Mita at the end going, "Come to Greece, you deserve to be happy too, or you deserve to get what you want too." And I was like, "There's my headcanon for him leaving, going off with Mita, doing, you know, still having a career, being great, and having some happiness." So if we don't get the spinoff of his life. In my head, he gets a happy ending too.
And she's not a villain either.
No.
Yeah, no, she's not.
Yeah.
Yeah. I dig it as a team up. I revise my previous request. I want Alexander and Mita sex players on the Mediterranean.
I mean, this is a Netflix miniseries where we can just sort of meet up with everyone in the movie at various points throughout the next 4 or 5 years.
I love it.
So, Julia, I would like to give you the space now to be our Eurovision expert and tell us, how is this movie? Because I can tell, like, watching it, you're like, this is loaded with references, I feel, and drop-ins in characters, and especially the crazy smash-up party.
The song-along.
Yes, the song-along.
It's so good.
That's so great. So I want you to tell us, how does this hold up as a Eurovision fan?
100%, 130%, 12 points from the Swedish jury. Like, some of the very small specifics, like you don't have the juried vote read out loud at the semifinals, but that's really just like nitpicky.
That's drama.
And it works better for, yeah, exactly. But what's so funny, like I was saying, it works if you know the stuff and if you don't. But what I think is almost an extra layer of funny is watching it as someone who knows it very well and being like, somebody who doesn't will think that this is when Will Ferrell has just like taken things and run with them. It's like, no, nothing in this movie is exaggerated. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Almost everything you see is either a very open reference to an actual act or just a straight up copy. Like everything right off references specific acts, specific, you know, events, chaos.
Including and the hamster wheel?
Exactly. The hamster wheel has been used. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are so many things that they couldn't. And I mean, this is a classic thing that you say about art in general, but like so many things that you couldn't have put in it because it would have seemed too ridiculous if you didn't know it was a direct reference. And like, even, you know, to me, I'm like, okay, so all the silver makeup is probably a reference to Sylvia Knight, who competed for Iceland, you know, over 10 years ago. And just like all these tiny things. And I think you really would see it as just this bizarre thing. And like little things like, you know, Everybody Hates Great Britain. It's true. They haven't won since the mid-90s. And also they keep sending weirder and weirder acts. And people are like, well, are you trying to lose? Are you like, and there's always all this talk about, you know, conspiracies. You joke about neighboring countries vote for each other. You have to yell as, because I go to viewing parties every year for Eurovision with my friends.
I would like to do that.
When the world exists again, we will do it digitally. Like, we assign all the points. We have a very specific point system. You know, there's 12 points total, but you give a point for the, there's 5 points for the song, a certain number of points for clothes, for moves, for all of our vibe, and for the ever important key change, which sadly is less and less utilized, because there's this very strong formula. It has to be 3 minutes. You can't have more than six people on stage, which is actually where the Swedish contestant in this movie would have been disqualified, because he has six dancers, which makes seven people. So, you know, all these little things, but like there are actual artists who don't just show up in the song along, but show up in other places. And it's just like, because the, for instance, the Swedish artist is an actual Swedish artist who has competed. And a lot of the singing voices, both Sigrid's and Alexander's, and like lots of them are done by Swedish singers, which to me is extra hilarious. And the main baddie is playing by one of Sweden's foremost actors. Like, it's, I don't know if Will Ferrell's wife made him do that. But it's just like so many of these things, all of the staging, all of the props, the songs, the artists, all of them are just pulled straight from reality. And like I said, it's amazing to watch because you're like, I know that. And you're like, and what does an American make of this? Because if you don't understand that, like, and different countries, a lot of countries will have their own sort of song contest where people can vote and there could be semifinals there. In some cases, it's the governing body of public television and so on and so forth. But it is like, it's a huge thing. It's so important. Some people will like it ironically, but even the people who like and watch ironically will halfway through the final just like care deeply. And it's just so important. And I could keep going forever and ever. I will ask Annette to post in the show notes the video that I linked where the Swedish hosts from a few years ago went, Sweden hosted because we won the year before. They have this amazing sort of variety number about how you write the perfect Eurovision song. And I don't know if I should make a YouTube playlist showing where each and every reference is from, because it's exactly the same thing. You'd be like, wait, why are there little old Russian ladies holding bread and a half-naked woman churning butter? What is going on? Every reference straight from reality, literally. And it's just, it's the most of everything. It's like all of the biggest things that you can imagine just smushed together with extra sequence, complete earnestness, tiny bit of irony, but still mostly earnest irony. Just all the things, the kitchen sink, more sparkles, and sugar and butter. I'm waving my hands so much in my room right now.
I'll also post the video. I found one that has all of the Eurovision winners from the 1950s till last year. And it's fascinating to see the evolution of it, too. And actually, you can tell ABBA, when they won in 1974, there's like a shift after that. And then there's like another shift in the 2000s where it kind of gets bigger and glitzier. And it was like really fascinating to watch.
And because they're also, for instance, again, little things like when she starts singing in Icelandic at the end of the movie, it's both like it's super, you know, poignant because they talk about like nobody's ever won with a song in Icelandic. And it's, there have been sort of waves of, because they only changed the rules in like the 70s, I think, so that you could sing in another language than your own. That was a very hard rule, which meant that like, England, France, Germany had a huge advantage because we could at least understand mm-hmm. sort of what they were saying. But then a lot of countries have gone back to where they mix. So it's both that she sings Icelandic to sort of connect her to her own country and tradition, but also connects her to a very specific through line in Eurovision of daring to go back to singing to your own tiny, you know, like when someone sings in Moldovan or whatever it might be. And so there are just so many, not just jokes, but also very sort of heartfelt things that are very true and very sweet.
I admittedly have far less experience at Eurovision, but I have a little bit of experience figuring out how to watch it over the years in bits and pieces as it's going. And I just started belly laughing at the Belarus group doing their wolf song because it was so precisely perfectly Eurovision, especially from that particular area. And it just, I loved how it never felt like it was punching down. Was it ridiculous? Was it over the top? It felt incredibly accurate, albeit, you know, I haven't watched like every act every year for years, but I've caught bits over the years, and it just, it felt so respectful on that front, and that was what I was worried about the most.
Yeah, every aspect of it, it's like all of the acts are like at the top of their game. Like they're like, oh, this is like really hard to get into because everyone is so talented. You know, all of the like production people that you see are like supposed to be excellent at their jobs. Like they are the ones who screw up. Like Fire Saga are the ones that like mm-hmm. mess up. It's never due to anyone else's fault but their own.
But I think it's also so funny that everyone is completely agreed that, oh, they suck. And I'm like,
they're great. I know.
They don't suck.
They don't suck at all.
They have some logistical problems, but then it's also like, again, tiny nitpick, they would get to do their song again. It's happened, for instance, when somebody ran on stage in a clown suit and mooned the cameras.
Oh. I was wondering, too, when I rewatched it, and they're at the beginning when the people at Icelandic Public Television are watching. I love that Demi Lovato is in this movie, just singing her face off, like, totally. And they're watching that, and they say that she's from, like, whatever, and I assume it's a city. And so it felt like there was, like, a class issue there as well, where they were like, well, there's no way that these two people from this, like, fishing town could be as good as this, like, sophisticated, polished act. I don't know if that's, like, necessarily true, but that's what I kind of felt like that was an aspect, too.
Can we talk about the elves? I don't know why this is, like, such a funny sled plot.
I would love to talk about the elves.
Elves?
Well, the thing is, again, this is, again, someone with love and knowledge and understanding, because mm-hmm. Iceland has this deep tradition of deep and, like, weird and lovingly hilarious mythology. Like, they have the Yule lads, which now there are 13. There used to be even more, and they like they do these little tricks. Like there's the sausage stealing Yule elf, and the yeah, like they do these tricks.
Is there one that does murder?
That's the thing. The ones that have been like sort of canonized are more or less like not even harmless, but like tricksters. They're not scary. They're tricksters, and like, you know, they're partially so that you will behave around Christmas, mm-hmm. And like not leave your shoes out and clean up and like not, you know, do the dishes and whatever. But they are the children of this horrible witch. Originally, there were hundreds of them. They include elves like Lung Slapping Santa, who is a little sort of elf Yule lad trickster who has his lungs outside his body and will slap you with them. That's like that kind of thing.
Terrifying.
That witch also has a cat, Julekitteri. There's a song about it that you can hear by Bjork on Spotify. That if you didn't get any new clothes for Christmas, it comes and eats you.
Aww.
Damn. So there's just this, like, and I mean, a lot of this, like, so much folklore is about, like, let's keep people from dying. We need to teach children, don't go outside because it is dark. You will break your legs.
It's all about following the rules. We need to follow the rules.
But also to sort of insert a little magic. So I love mm-hmm. that when she goes there, and I think the movie, again, does it with love and respect. You don't feel that she's, like, you know, nutty or super old school or whatever. It's just, like, this is a part of her life, like, you know, touching wood or whatever it might be. But yeah, again, somebody knows their stuff here and I love it. And the elves, and cause I was kind of thinking like, I really want to see if they take this to the literal at some point in this movie, you know,
with the little door slam.
I know that's such a great, I love that they don't show it. And it's just like little it's slam.
You can't have like a little elf. Like it's just, it's too good when you don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
So often the whole thing is, oh, I was so clever. Oh, I saw that coming. I did not see that coming. And no. I did not know how he was going to get out of this garrote around his neck. And it was so satisfying. It was so satisfying.
They also serve like a really, they also serve another story purpose because like Sigrid doesn't have anybody to talk to about like how she feels. And so that mm-hmm. like the first time she goes to talk to them, like it's so, it was so sweet to me. Like it's like she only tells the elves that she's like been in love with this man like their whole lives. Like it's very
and she comes back, is like, wait, one more thing, just, you know, not important right now, but just right. You know,
if we could win.
It's like the equivalent of, you know, if something happens in a household, you have to tell the bees about it because they will grieve or be happy for you. It's kind of like just this part of her that is important, and I love it.
Yeah, and she doesn't have any friends in this movie, unfortunately, so, like, there's nobody else to sort of, like, give that, in, like, that exposition to.
That moment when she says, the elves went too far.
The elves went too far.
Because that's the thing. They're not just benevolent, and they're not just helpful, or it is kind of like a monkey paw thing, you know, be careful what you wish for, because it may not come about the way that you think. Did you know that it actually... an Icelandic artist did actually die, who won the national tryouts, did die before he could go to Eurovision.
Oh, no.
And his family was like, no, we still want it to go on. And so six of his friends got together and performed the song that he wrote.
Oh,
and
it's, my God.
And they called him, I think his name was Sigun, and their like group name was Sigun's Friends. And they performed this song about looking back, which is like, goosebumps and tears.
It's so emotional. Rachel McAdams is great at delivering lines like that because mm-hmm. that the elves went too far just reminded me of her in Game Night saying, oh no, he died. Which is one of my favorite line readings in like film history.
And anyone who has not seen Game Night,
you gotta
watch
it
because then you will immediately want to watch it again. It's so good.
How do you think they, like, the arc of the romance works for a rom-com, I'm going to call it, because I think it is ultimately a rom-com within this musical competition movie.
Because I love the running joke that they're probably not siblings. Because they have their last names suggest that they have at least a father with the same name. But they're like, it's so, because Iceland is so small that there's actually an app that somebody has developed so that before you start dating someone, you know how closely related you are. Like it's again, it's a joke on so many levels. And I just, because they never really like make it clear either way. Like, oh, you know, we've tried and it didn't work, or somebody has turned somebody else down. It's kind of like, you know, we're in this rut and it's kind of nice. And it, if you don't think about the fact too much that technically they should both be in like their mid 50s, which makes the mm-hmm. baby kind of weird, but actually would make sense to ask the elves, because it's like, you know, you're the only ones who could actually make this happen. But it's just, it's such a sweet little story. And you know, the misunderstandings and the, you know, sort of blindness and not seeing of, nothing of it is, like, egregious in the way where it needs a huge, like, a huge thing to come back to. Like, when he comes back for her, it is not for her love, it's for her as a person, which is more romantic than a big romantic gesture to me. Does that make sense? Like,
yes.
He comes back because this is important to her, and not because this is important to her and he wants to show her his love that way.
If anything, it's the inversion of it, where he's been doing the grand gesture over and over, but not wanting the simple things, and him embracing the simple reasons why they work so well together. The reason that all of the big theatricality that they engage in works so well is because they are so close. And trying to be overly critical of this movie, you're not watching the movie for the right reasons. So, like, the age difference between the two of them, I don't care. You know, the being able to pinpoint precisely about how old, you know, is Will Ferrell supposed to be in his, like, mid to late 20s, I guess?
No, because they're both kids in 1974. They're very specific. So both of them have to be in their 50s.
So even if you interpret present day loosely, I'm like, I feel like they have to at least be in their 40s.
And that shows just how little I was caring or paying that much attention to that part of it. It didn't matter to me because the authenticity of the connection between the two of them, you know, when you see them as kids and then you jump forward and they're adults, they are both very good at their jobs, and it mattered a lot more that it felt like they had that length of relationship and they had that common language between the two of them, so much that is spoken and so much that is unspoken. It was wonderful.
What also makes it an amazing romantic story is that the movie would have worked just as well as a sort of platonic love story. Mm-hmm. Like, you could have taken out the sex party parts or even, like, you know, reverse genders, same genders, like, no, because, like, what it is about, like, you know, two hearts singing from their hearts in an acoustic version and meeting in perfect harmony. You know, like, it's and that's how you tell a really good, I think, love story, is when it's about people.
I read, like, something, I was reading, I just crossed my path on Tumblr, and someone was like, these are my top 10, like, rules for writing. And one of them was like, if your characters have to kiss for you to know that they're in, for people to know that they're in love, then you're not writing it right. And that's, like, kind of how I felt about this movie. The whole concept of, like, wanting to support someone else's dreams that are close to yours, but not exactly the same, and sort of the selflessness of that, but also how that can be very difficult and how it can be really rewarding because, you know, it's not all about you, is great. And I loved about their relationship too, the entire time, that they're constantly, like, building each other up, like, constantly, like, every time she sings, he's like, that's the best you've ever sounded, you know, like, it's just, they have such a great basis of friendship. That you, like, you do, I would say, like, of anybody, it is a little bit harder to understand, like, Lars's point, because he's like, what about the band? And it's like, your band is two people, you know, you'll figure it out. Yeah, it just has, like, a really sweet arc.
I think, for me, I really loved Sigrid's arc, because that moment when she finally asks for him to do something, and she's the one who stands up, keeps going, and he follows her, which I think shows how much she is still part of that partnership, and he is listening and paying attention to her perhaps more than he even gets, and he's like, okay, so we're doing this and we're singing. And then she asks him and says, you know, she's like, I'm going into that room and I'm going to face the music and I'm going to be an artist, because that's what an artist does. And if that's, you know, and I was like, that moment was so powerful. And she says, I want you to follow, like, I'm asking you to do this one thing. And then he totally rejects that. And it's like this heartbreaking moment. And then, like, when Alexander, in just the utter kindness of him to sit and hold her hand before they know, like, before he, like, and he's like, you're probably going to get 0 points and it's going to be fine. And then celebrating with him and stuff. And I don't know, that whole moment was so great. So then, you know, for, like Lars to come around and understand what he needs to do for Secret. But it was like that moment she finally asked for what she wanted, whereas most of the time she is going with what he wants and supporting him. And it, she just like, she finally stood up for herself and did something so brave. And she was just so brave all the time as a character. And that gentle way.
Where he comes from is like relatable, where I think a lot of people like want the stage and they want the popularity, but they're just not prepared for the potential failure aspect of it. Like she doesn't even want necessarily to like personally to the degree that she wants it for him and because of him and because she like believes in their music, but like she doesn't care necessarily for herself about being like on that stage. But she's the one who's like, listen, it didn't work out, but we're here and like that's a part of it. Yeah, it just shows like incredible strength of character.
Mm-hmm. And it's because one of my sort of romance catnips is when both parties are giving up what they want for the other person without realizing it. Here it's so lovely because they take turns giving it up and that helps them see that they actually want the same thing. Because he's like, you know, I'd like the original version of Volcano Man better, but this is what we have to send to Eurovision because that's what will work. Very much like, don't try to guess what people want. Don't try to be someone else, because the real magic note is inside you all along.
And what he really wants, like, all boils down to is, like, he wants his dad to respect him, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, and that's what this is all about. Like, he thinks somehow if he can prove to his dad that this dream was not fruitless, then, like, he'll be happy. And so when his dad is proud of him, then it's like, okay, well, that's it. That's actually what this was all about. And now we can kind of, like, go, like, fabulously throw this entire competition in a way that, like, no one's ever going to forget, because that's not what even really mattered.
I love that so much, that in the end, because the song is so much about what Secret actually wants and what's important to her and what's important to them. And it's just, and that, but, and yet that's what makes the song work so well, is that it is from the heart and it's not trying to be that formula that Julia was talking about earlier where you have to do all these things. But it's like, this was a, that song to me is just, it's a beautiful song. And that moment made me reclamped. I like actually was like, I think I'm going to cry a little bit now.
Emotional.
100%.
All of the hair on my body was standing on end. And what is so funny that, again, this is a song that I could see at 20 different Eurovisions and it could have won in at least three of them. So it's not that like this isn't a Eurovision song. It's just my magic. This song could also have won. And I love that that the disqualification thing comes up before she sings it so that you don't get the letdown of like, oh, and also they're disqualified. They say it first. So it's an open decision, not just between them, but to the audience as well. So that this song is like sort of set free from and separate from any actual sort of pressure in the context of the contest, which is a really nice way of doing it.
And it's a tremendous showcase of something else that Rachel McAdams does quite well, in addition to her comedic chops, which we have praised roundly already, which is, it is rare that an actor is this good at selling lip syncing to someone else singing and pulling it off. And she pulls it off. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
And they've done a really good job of sort of mixing the behind the curtain singer with her so that you get just enough of sort of her tone that it can be almost believable that it's her.
I read that they were going to do the same with Dan Stevens, but COVID prevented them from doing that final mix.
Oh, that's a bummer.
So I was like, oh, that's because he actually can sing because he was in Beauty and the Beast. So I was like, oh, that would have been a nice touch. So,
well, for the spinoff.
Yes.
But they get that reference in when he's, you know, tells them to be his guest in the in the castle.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Oh, that didn't even occur to me.
I missed that.
I did enjoy the referential moment of Pierce Brosnan watching ABBA perform Waterloo. That made my Mamma Mia heart very happy.
Right.
How is this as a vacation movie for, I guess, Iceland and Scotland, because we have that great little montage of touring around Edinburgh, which I thought was quite fun.
I want to go to Iceland immediately. I think it's so gorgeous. And I love that the song, like, just makes this reference to this, like, very peaceful, like, beautiful place. I was looking on IMDb, and it's really sweet. Like, if you look through the IMDb reviews, there are a lot of them that are like, thank you from Iceland. Like, this is one of the few times I felt such emotions while watching a movie. Many people, not Icelanders, criticize this movie, saying that it's embarrassing for Icelanders and makes us look stupid. Well, to tell you the truth, they got us, in my mind, pretty accurately. Made a freaking account just to write this. Thanks from Iceland, and have a good one. So stuff like that, that's very sweet, where it made me feel like there were elements of it that were pretty on point. And it just, the scenery was so stunning and beautiful. And also, I really want to go drink in that bar.
Yeah.
And demand Yaya Ding Dong. I want to go to there and wear a sweater. Like, it's so hot in New York right now, and all I want to do is be in Iceland in a bar drinking a stein and drinking from a stein and wearing a sweater, singing Yaya Ding Dong. The end.
I feel that big time coming from deep in the heart of Texas. I want somewhere that is covered in ice for basically the whole year. I just want to cool off for a week.
My husband has been to Iceland twice for work things, and he says that it's actually another very funny accuracy that Icelanders are very skeptical of any kind of foreigners. So his, like, no, we hate you. We really, really do.
Love
at
it.
The end is, like, extra hilarious. I have Iceland on my dream list and have for many years because it has so many of the things that I like tiny horses and lots of wool and knitting and hot springs and you know, green fields and all of that. And again, like, this amazing nature, amazing folklore. Yeah, I think, because, like, you know, I'm from Sweden. We're a tiny nation of 10 million people. The country's the size of California, but it's too cold to live in most of it. And, you know, we get happy when someone mentions us in any kind of culture. So, like, Iceland, which I think is possibly bigger in area, but has, like, a population of, like, 300,000-400,000 people, it must be even more magical to be like, we exist. Someone said Iceland. And they are also very passionate and very good at Eurovision and have an amazing breadth of what they send. And I want to go there and look at all the things and go in all the hot water and buy all the yarn. You can buy yarn of high quality very cheaply in, like, the grocery store. And my husband brought me back half a suitcase because he knows me.
Aw.
But I also want to go back to Scotland. I've only visited once to do an interview, and I wasn't there long. And just, like, the castle at the top of the mountain, and also pubs with people in sweaters, I'm assuming.
Also, not to be dark about this, but Iceland totally just, like, killed COVID. There's almost nothing there. They did exactly what they were supposed to do, unlike, you know, where I am. So, I would like to go for that as well.
I mean, because Iceland and Finland both had the amazing sort of opportunity of having small populations that are very used to staying inside, right, and who felt that 6 feet was very uncomfortably close to other people.
A while back, Icelandic Air started flying out of Edmonton, the airport, and part of their deal here is that, because to fly to Europe, you can fly... and, like, entice us into using their airline, they will let us have a free stopover. So you can, for free, fly to Iceland, stay as long as you want, and then continue your journey to wherever you're going in Europe. So around here, everyone's doing that. So everyone, like, we're just like, Iceland, Iceland, Iceland. Everyone should go to Iceland, because I haven't heard anyone who's gone and not enjoyed spending, like, 3 or 4 days on their trip to somewhere else. Spending time there, and so seeing again these beautiful scenes in the ocean and the mountains and the landscape, it definitely puts it on my list.
As someone who also lives near the Arctic Circle, I will say to any and everyone who wants to go, pick the right sort of 3 months of the year, because if you're not used to both the cold, the wet, bone-biting cold, but also the dark, Because if you're not used to the very, very northern parts of the world, understanding how dark and how much dark, it's hard on the soul.
Other thing about Iceland that that I look forward to is all the fresh fish. I love fish.
Oh, and I want to add to Julia's knitwear. Like, Sigrid's knitwear was outstanding, and I would go there for the knitting as well.
All of her clothes were so good, and her hair was so cute. Her like little space buns.
Oh,
I love.
I want her.
Her
hair. I wish I could have that perfect wave happening.
Like wave, I know. And then also, I loved her like gigantic sequin dress that she wears to the song
that was
long party.
So good.
I love it.
It was so good that my husband was like, that dress is amazing.
Yeah.
and that's not even like a gendered thing. It's just like not usually something that he points out. And I was like, I have to make that dress.
Yeah.
Make that dress.
Please
right now.
Do.
Then we want pictures.
Yeah, the costumes were terrific and so fun.
Yeah. And like the diversity of costume from like the performance costumes to the like costumes of the quote unquote regular people doing their everyday things. I'm going to ask for final thoughts, and I'm going to say the last thing that I really like, the ending where the whole town like really comes around them when they drive in and they're so proud of them. But then at the same time, they're back doing sometime in the future, having a baby standing in front of stage, and they still just don't want to hear your stupid Eurovision song. Just sing Ya Ya Ding Dong. It's just like, yeah, it's like you got their respect. They love you for what you did, but we don't want to hear that beautiful song. Just sing Ya Ya Ding Dong.
Ugh.
Just made me laugh.
The baby with the little headphones on.
Mm-hmm.
Can't.
So cute. So anyone else? Final thoughts before we wrap up this penultimate leg of our vacation.
It's actually really funny because for a long time, Iceland has been a stopover between many European cities and like the US or Northern America. So it felt really funny to be like, we just had to add this extra stop.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, this is a movie like... I know that you've all rewatched it several times, but I feel like this is a movie that both you can rewatch in quick succession and just like pick up anytime you need it. Like it is like the perfect, you know, Icelandic patterned sweater to just slip on, comfy socks. I don't think this movie will ever fail to make me feel good. And the songs will go in my Eurovision list. In my playlist in Spotify. I just wish that the recording of Ya Ya Ding Dong was longer, but...
Leave them wanting more.
This is quality comfort food. Like, just quality, all the nutrients and vitamins you need in a buttery sauce.
I completely agree. I would love, like, 10 more movies that have this same sort of tone and love for the source material or the material that was the inspiration, that have these sort of really committed, sensitive, and yet hilarious performances, amazing songs. I will 100% keep coming back to this movie, and I think it's one of those movies that I will end up sharing with a lot of people. Like, you know, those movies where if somebody says, well, I haven't seen that, and you're like, okay, we're turning it on.
We're going home right now.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, this is unacceptable. This definitely feels like one to just keep on sharing. And I just, it again, like anything that sort of makes me feel good at this time, I love even more than I probably would at another time. So it just really felt like a nice hug.
I don't believe in guilty pleasures, and there are very few things that I like, ironically. But like this is something that like it's not so bad. It's good. It's good. I love it earnestly, unironically, and I will blow some sort of battle horn in the face of anyone who disagrees.
No guilt, all pleasure. This movie for me, Sage and I think were in college at the same time, not at the same place. I couldn't have been that lucky to have been able to socialize with someone with such incredibly good taste. But as we are contemporaries, I think that the early mid-aughts, there was that time when there would be those movies that just about everybody would have on DVD,
mm-hmm.
just because you never know. when, you know, in my case, in Florida, it's going to be a hurricane weekend where you just kind of stay in. But this feels like exactly that kind of movie, like Old School. Loads of people had copies of Old School, which, you know, had some of its own issues when you look at it in the rearview mirror. But it was a movie that did not take itself too seriously and was willing to embrace sentiment at different points. And that's something that I find common across Will Ferrell's entire filmography. And I love that as his career has progressed, he does not have to overpower the narrative. And that's why I think this movie works so well, is that there is room for Rachel McAdams. There is room for Dan Stevens. There's room for, I think her name is Natasha Demetrio from What We Do in the Shadows, who shows up for like 5 minutes.
Such an amazing cameo.
she just parachutes in and gives me a little dose of joy.
I do think it is kind of the perfect movie for a COVID pandemic because it is, I like the concept of it being a hug. I thought going in, I was going to like it ironically, to be honest. I was like, it'll be kind of fun. But then I was just like, no, I love it wholeheartedly. And I think part of why I love it wholeheartedly is because this is the movie and the feel that I would like now. And my husband came down yesterday and he was laughing because I was like sniffling on the couch again at the ending. And I was like, oh, stop it. And he just laughs. But it's like, oh, it just is such a little perfect thing for this moment when so many things are stressful and awful. So thank you.
It's almost even more a perfect COVID movie because it was gonna be released to coincide with the actual Eurovision Song Contest in May. And again, it's such a funny thing, which they couldn't have known when they started, that this year's Icelandic song was amazing and could have won. And it was just like, okay, you didn't get the real thing, but here is your magic underdog story.
I also like how they never explain why they're called Fire Saga. Because I don't kind of want to know. It's just too good and random. Yeah.
On that note, we are going to wrap up our Icelandic vacation. So thank you so much for coming with me. And thank you, Sage, for instigating this by making me realize that, oh, yeah, there's more of us out there. I don't have to hide in the shadows.
Sage was the Fire Saga all along.
Thank you for enabling me.
Thank you, everyone. Agents of Smooch is part of the Incomparable Network, where you can find many great pop culture podcasts. If you're enjoying our show and our virtual vacation, please tell your friends or leave us a review on your favorite podcatcher. You can find us on Twitter at Agents of Smooch. And you can become a member of the Incomparable Network at theincomparable.com. Our members get some fun extra perks, including our growing list of incomprehensible Agents of Smooch tipsy commentaries. And until next time, agents, stay safe.